Accession number 9876, reel 3.
Mr. Dennis, reel 3. We were talking about discipline and an yes. instance of bullying that arose, and that takes us rather onto that subject. Yes. Was there much bullying going on at the school?
I would say that there was not. Not much. Insofar as it existed, it was inclined to be restricted to a very few people in the school, very few boys who were in schoolboy in our local language. They were called punts because people punted them. Well, in fact, they were not usually hurt by anybody, but they were treated with very great derision. And as I was said earlier on, they were pushed out of their place in queues, and so that they had to come in at the back and that sort of thing.
You called them punts.
Punts.
What did that actually? That
well, in strictness, it meant people whose bottoms you kicked, but it wouldn't be right to pretend that their bottoms were kicked. They weren't. They were treated pretty badly, but not physically.
And you edged into that.
I was never in that category. I was always in utter danger of finding myself in it.
Did this prey on your nerves at all? I mean, I know your school days made an impression on you because what I read.
I don't think it preyed on my nerves. What I think it did was make me skeptical, as I still am, about the advantages of that system of government education at all. I am inclined to think that boarding school education is wrong for most boys.
Did you feel, I mean, you were close to this section of people, did you feel sorry for them?
Oh yes, I did. And I knew some of them in later life. It did great psychological harm to some. Others appeared to be entirely unscathed.
What was their crime in the schoolboy circle? What were they doing that was so unpopular?
Well, being no good at games, but good at work. It sounds silly, but that was sufficient to put people off. On the other hand, who was not a punt, was no good at games and was good at work. Generally, there was a third element that made boys come into this unfortunate category. That was some peculiarity, some physical peculiarity. For instance, one boy was much derided because when he walked he sprung on his heels like this. Doesn't sound much, but it was, I think, with boys of that age, almost any peculiarity attracts attention, and it's not favourable attention. But I hadn't got any embarrassing peculiarity of that kind, and I think that helped.
Just another point. Was there much instance of homosexuality in the school?
There was quite a lot at Malvern. There was an awful lot of talk about it. When the school term, school year started, new boys would come, and one would hear that some of them were what they called tots. there used to be an awful lot of talk about this. I don't think there was such a very great deal of actual acts of sodomy and gross indecency and so on, but there was an awful lot of talk about it, much more than there ought to have been. Those of us who were not homosexually inclined disliked it very much. Used to keep ourselves like the Levite on the other side. But boys that had some slight tendency in that direction certainly spent a lot of time thinking about it and talking about it. And
you think that people with a slight tendency that way were encouraged in a manner that wouldn't have happened in a normal school? In other words, that the atmosphere...
Well, I'm bound to tell you that I'm afraid Malvern was a normal school. Practically any boarding public school was the same. I used to talk in the holidays to boys from other schools, and they told me exactly the same thing. They said, there's a lot of homosexuality. We don't do it ourselves, but a lot of the boys do. But it's one reason why I'm against boarding schools.
But you would restate that it was mainly talk.
I would say that there was more talk than action, but there was some action. I can remember when it was suddenly discovered that it had been going on, and about six boys' parents were asked to take them away forthwith. One was a peculiarly agreeable boy who was, in spite of being requested on those grounds, was accepted at Dartmouth, went in the Navy, and was killed after a short but very good career. That was the sort of thing that was liable to happen.
Now, we're moving into 1914 now. At the start of the year, and as the year progressed, did you have any anticipation of war breaking out in 1914?
None whatever. The first time I really realised there was anything in the wind was when my father, who was on retirement leave in England, came down to visit the OTC camp I was in Salisbury Plain, about 3 days, I think, before the outbreak of war, and told me that there would be war in a day or two, and that it would be extremely sanguinary and would last a long time, which was exactly what most people didn't believe. But he was a professional soldier, and I think he knew that we hadn't got the equipment or anything. Well, he left to join his Indian regiment in Egypt, and they broke up the camp on Salisbury Plain, and we were all sent home.
Now, this seems to indicate that there wasn't much following within, by you certainly, of what was going on in the wider world. Did you not read newspapers?
Oh, yes, I did, and I read about what the Germans were up to, and I must have thought that it was quite likely to end in a war, but I think we still believed that it wasn't certain that we'd be in the war until the invasion of Belgium, and then we knew we were bound to be.
Now, you'd actually been sent home from Salisbury,
yes.
Went on the day war. That was before war broke out,
yes.
Was it? So, what were you actually doing on August the 4th? The bank holiday.
I just can't remember. Can't remember.
Now, what was your personal reaction then to the outbreak of war? Did you share in the popular thing, or did you agree with your father?
Well, I certainly thought my father was right, because he was inclined to be right about subjects like that. I never thought it would be quick, but I thought it might be quick, and that I had better get in the army, or I should miss it.
Now, what makes you think that? I mean, what sort of thinking went behind that? Why didn't you want to miss it? You know, that sort of thing.
Ah, because it would seem natural in the family that I was brought up in that if there was a war, it would be very wrong not to be in it. It was, I suppose, not entirely family tradition, because lots of people with no military background at all also felt they'd got to be there quickly. But I thought I'd got to get in quick.
Was this a family concept of duty?
I suppose it may have been.
Were you very patriotic at the time?
I think so. Yes. Yes, I think I was, and I think all the people around me were.
Were there any outside factors influencing you and wanted to get involved quickly?
No. No, not really.
So you decided. How did you go about getting?
Well, what I did, I went within a matter of 2 or 3 weeks. I think I went down to Seaford, where an elder brother of my father had been dug out of retirement and told to start and raise a battalion of the Loyal North Lancashires. And he was in tents in Seaford. And I went round to him and said, I want to join. And he said, well, you better... He gave me a share in somebody's tent, and I was about to join.
As a private or as an officer?
The idea was that I should get a commission. But what did happen was that I was discovered to be only 17, and I was sent straight back to school. So,
were you there? How long were you there?
Oh, 2 or 3 days only.
Did you have time to?
I wasn't sworn in.
Did you have time to gain an impression of what was happening at Seaford?
Well, there were a lot of fine chaps from Lancashire. They hadn't got a uniform. They were kitted out with blue uniform that the War Office somehow had got. And they were killed largely on the Somme later. But I went back to school. And to my surprise, it never occurred to me that this would happen, but when I got back to school, I found I was considered to be quite a sort of heroic character having done what I thought everybody would do, which was try to join the army. But it made all the difference in my status. I found myself promoted to be sergeant major in the school corps. And I used to amuse myself trying to imitate the ways of regular guard sergeant majors, sort of rolling about in a rather portentous way. Button. Haircut. This kind of.
What did your parents think about this whole?
My father was in Egypt, and very shortly after that in France. So what he thought, I really couldn't. My mother was left to handle the situation.
Where did she think you'd gone? Could you?
Oh, I told her.
How had she reacted?
Well, she didn't discourage me. She obviously thought it was the proper thing to do. But she got a series of abusive letters from my headmaster saying, where was I? And time I got back to school and instead of this nonsense.
Did he know you'd joined up?
Oh, he heard that I'd tried to join up, and he held that it was completely wrong and I should be back at school. My mother was bothered about this, but the thing was settled by my being sent.
And get on board. And with us, of course, it was no good. We couldn't open fire on this artillery because it was long range stuff and it was a very long way away and we had no idea where it was. As I say, we only did the one trip lifting troops, and after that we were used on the German end of the beaches at Newport mostly to bombard their gun positions, and almost every day we closed right into the shore and opened up on their artillery, and of course we got very rude answers back from them, and we were bracketed all the time, and when we got really annoying they used to whistle up their own dive bombers, and we used to get quite heavily attacked off the beach. But it was no problem on the inner channel because you could work up to about 30 knots and zigzag at full speed, and the captain could always avoid the bombs by watching the bomb drop away and then going harder port or harder starboard and letting it drop a few yards off the bow on one side or the other. You had plenty of room in the inner channel to do this, but of course in the channel further down towards Bray, where the there was a great big sort of red brick building there and the troops were being picked up off there all the time, you didn't have a lot of room, and there were a lot of wrecks there that you had to avoid. So as far as possible we used to be up the other end of the beaches, but twice we had to go off to Calais. The Admiral sent us there to carry out bombardments of their artillery positions and to cover the beaches. And on the day before we got sunk, we picked up the Admiral Wake Walker, and he transferred his flag to us from the Hebe, which was a fleet sweeper. And he had us up and down the beach directing operations all the time, and you could say that out of 14 or so hours of daylight, we were being attacked by odd planes or little groups of planes about 12 times, I should think. About every hour we had an attack of some sort. And we got very, very tired because we were following at action stations night and day, and all you could do was to sit on the seat on the gun and catnap. And the last few days, of course, we were told to watch out for German E-boats. They were getting in amongst the evacuation ships. And what with gazing out at sea for E-boats and watching aircraft all day up in the sun, your eyes were beginning to fail on you a bit. And you got so tired you could just barely keep your eyes open during the day. And we had no real food. We had corned beef sandwiches and biscuits and hot cocoa passed up to the guns at intervals. But in the end, you didn't feel like eating that. You got so tired you didn't want to eat. And on the last day, we were in the deep water channel, almost off Dunkirk, well, off Bray and between Bray and Dunkirk. And it was a misty morning, and about 7:30 we heard this great roar of planes and coming up off the coast. There must have been about 600 or 700 planes. I'd never seen anything like it. It was a solid mass of them, and they were everything. There was 87s, 88s, Heinkels, 109s, 110s, and they were stepped up in piles. And when you look round where we were, there were about 4 ships on the inner channel. There was the Basilisk and the Skipjack, the Salamander, and us on just off the actual beach. And these planes, were about 60 of them, made a concerted attack on us. Well, we'd already worked up to full speed, and they came down in 4 lines, and the 3-inch suddenly stopped firing. They'd run out of ammunition, they'd got no more left at all, and we were down to about 25%, I suppose. And I followed one lot down, one line. I got one, he went into the water. I got another one in the second line as he came down, and he pulled out, and then the plane went into the water and the pilot bailed out, and he plummeted straight down, and his parachute didn't open, he was too low. But we suddenly got a whole stick of bombs landed right under the stern, and the ship absolutely shook from end to end, and then she started to go round in circles. And of course we were firing like mad, and they rigged up after steering from the tiller flat, and then we got a whole string of bombs down the starboard side, right where I was almost, and it blew in a part of the ship's side by the engine room, and we started to list to starboard. And then they got another load of bombs, and they got a bomb somewhere aft on the engine room, but it landed on the upper deck and went down into the engine room, and it killed everyone down there, killed everyone in the after boiler room as well. They were all blown to bits down there. And we stopped, and the captain ordered the anchors down, and we just sat there with these planes still hammering at us and us hammering back, and they didn't hit us anymore. And what happened then? Oh, they were attacking. I saw the Basilisk go down. They hit her with about a dozen bombs, and she turned right over and went down as she was travelling at full speed. And there was a small motor yacht near us, and they hit her as well. She disappeared. And a tug called the St. Abbs came rushing up. She's a big Admiralty tug from Devonport. And they started to transship the wounded and the chaps over the starboard side of our bow onto her, because we were slowly sinking. And she pulled away, and she only got about 200 yards off the ship, and they got a bomb right down her funnel, and she completely disintegrated with everyone on board. She just disappeared completely. And they'd already piped abandoned ship from the signal deck, and I'd got 3 chaps on my gun, so I said, well, the best thing to do is to go over the starboard side. I said, there's a fleet sweeper over there. There was a ship called the Salamander, and she was about 100 yards off on our starboard side, firing away under this rain of Stukas. So 2 of them went in, and a chap called Woodger and me, I said, well, there's no point in going in yet, she's not going to sink, we'll keep the gun going, because every time you saw a group of men in the water, the German planes came down and either bombed them or machine gunned them in the water. So the only thing we could do was to keep on the guns and try and keep these buggers off while our blokes swam to other ships. And we did this, but we were slowly settling on the listing to starboard. And we had the Admiral, he'd already transshipped to a motor torpedo boat. She came alongside and took him off and hoisted his flag, and he went in towards the beaches and left us. And I'd seen the captain going onto the St. Abbs with some of the crew and some of the wounded. And there wasn't many of us left on board, but we hung on there. But in the end, I couldn't get my gun to elevate enough because of the angle of the ship. I couldn't get it up enough in the air to be a much bloody good, and so in the end we had to go in the water, but that was about an hour after we'd abandoned ship. And we swam away from her and swam towards a motor lighter. There was a lighter towing some army lighters, these landing lighters. But we slowed down a lot because they were bombing us in the water, and the bombing was punching you right in the stomach all the time and making you sick. And we were in a big patch of oil, and we kept getting this oil in our mouths and eyes, and you couldn't get rid of it half the time. It was very bad. But anyway, this chap in this boat called the Servia, I believe it was, he came round and round time and time again, and eventually he picked up all those that were alive, although there were a lot of us dead in the water. And I crawled aboard this thing and got up under the gunwales there and went to sleep and didn't think any more of it. I thought, oh well, there's no gun, there's nothing more. And they landed me at Folkestone that night.
What condition were you in?
Well, I wasn't very happy. I was very, very thirsty. And this boat that picked me up had hardly got any water. And I got a drink out of a soldier's water bottle who was laying next to me, and he'd passed out, so I took a swig of that. But there was nothing to eat. And when we got alongside the jetty, we just laid on the jetty and went to sleep there. We didn't worry about moving. It was dark and no one seemed to know us or want us or anything, so we just lay down on the jetty and had a sleep until about 5 o'clock in the morning, when various army chaps came along and wanted to know what regiment and what I was and the rest of it. As soon as I said Navy, I was taken along to a place